Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is the great Sam Vecenie of The Athletic, and as you would expect, we spend a lot of time talking about the, I guess, pending-ish 2022 NBA draft, both how the top two players have fared and also the sales pitches for Jabari Smith and Jaden Ivey, who have worked their way into the top picks conversation, and two guys that I'm less familiar with. So we had a fun talk and explaining all that, and got into some other stuff, as Sam and I often do, including what's going on in Portland and various other components. Conversation runs a little bit under an hour, but a lot of good stuff in here, and we recorded this a couple days ago, so if there are any references that seem a teeny bit dated, it would be because of that, but it should be totally fine. The content is strong, as it always is with Sam. Thanks so much for coming on.
Danny, it's always a pleasure to be invited back to Real GM Radio. It is a beautiful day here in Melbourne. I went for a run this morning on January 2nd. We're recording in Melbourne. We're recording on your New Year's Day. So I'm glad that we got a chance to do this.
I am too. And you've written a little bit on how things have moved in terms of the 22 draft over the last few months. And there are a couple different places that I want to go on this. Some is you talked a little bit about the kind of the perceived depth of this class. Oh, that was an interesting piece that you wrote at The Athletic. I want to start a little bit, though, before that at the top. And Chet Holmgren, Paolo Banchero, seems like they're still the top two, but I know our colleague John Hollinger has been talking about Jabari Smith's place, and he was somebody that, for what appear to be pretty logical reasons, I was very unfamiliar with before this. So I guess let's start with Smith and where he fits in all this.
Yeah, so to generally paint the picture, right, I would say that all of Paolo Banchero, Chet Holmgren, Jabari Smith, and to a lesser extent, Jaden Ivey, I would still throw him in that mix, although I think that it would take a very specific team to take him at number one overall. Like, I don't know that anyone necessarily would take him over those guys, but I think that those four are very clearly the top guys. Mm-hmm. I honestly, among the top four, I probably personally would take Jabari Smith at number one right now.
Okay, and so what is the sales pitch?
Yeah, the sales pitch is pretty interesting. So he is younger than both Paolo and Chet by a pretty substantial margin. He's still 18 years old. I think he doesn't turn 19 until somewhere between March and May off the top of my head. He is 6'10", doesn't have like crazy length, but good length, like 7'1" wingspan, 7'1.5" wingspan, I would venture. Plays for Auburn. And I think that the critical point here is that he has come in a little bit more ready for college basketball, both on the offensive and defensive end, than what I think people anticipated. He's always been this guy that was considered a super high upside player, but a lot of these players in this mold end up being a bit more raw by the time that they get to college. We've seen a lot of these tall shooters get to college and struggle early on in their collegiate career. But Jabari Smith, you kind of have to go back and you look through the numbers. You look at his high school numbers. Now you look at the college numbers. You look at the shooting mechanics. You look at his comfort level on the perimeter. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that removing like the Kevin Durant level, like freak shows from the world, you know, including Jaren Jackson Jr., including Lauri Markkanen, including all of these big 6'10" to 7-foot-tall shooters that have entered the NBA over the past, let's say, 7 years, something like that. I think he's probably the best shooting prospect among these guys to enter the NBA. And it has to do with the crispness of his mechanics. He can do it off of relocation pull-ups. Like, he can take, one or two dribbles to the right, one or two dribbles to the left, stop, step back, pull up from three off the catch. He's not like a self-creator necessarily, unless he's out in transition, where he is a very effective grab-and-go weapon right now. Where he can go and just like get to the mid-range and pull up, or go and get to the three-point line and pull up. Defensively, he has great mobility. I think that he is going to profile really, really well on the defensive end as a switchable player in the NBA. He's a smart help side defender. He has good active hands. I look at Jabari Smith and I see him, if it all goes right for Jabari Smith, right? You try and figure out what the highest upside is. If it all goes right for Paolo Banchero, if it all goes right for Chet Holmgren, right? I think that if it all goes right for Jabari Smith in comparison to it all going right for those other guys, I think that Jabari Smith's ceiling is probably just a little bit higher than both of those two players. And that would take some real improvement in terms of his ball handling ability and his ability to consistently create his own shot out of pick and rolls and out of different scenarios. But I think that if it gets there, his ceiling is just immensely, immensely high.
That's fascinating. What I'm trying to piece together, so when you started that out, I was thinking offensively, I'm not talking about their physical profiles. We'll get to there in a second. Mm-hmm. I was thinking something like what Michael Porter Jr. has been so far for the Nuggets when he's been available.
Yeah.
Yep. But what's interesting is Michael Porter Jr., I mean, you know this as well as anybody, he had that on-ball game before the back injuries. And whether it was because he didn't have that at the like high-end NBA level, or it was just that was something that didn't really transfer after a couple of years out, that the other guy that I thought of as you got later in it, it's sort of in a way like what a taller version of what Bradley Beal became, where it's like you're not the every down quarterback, that's not what you're going to be, but you can be an active piece in kind of two other facets. That's really interesting.
Yeah, the guy that I would say that Jabari Smith should watch tape of, not necessarily that he is this guy yet, because this guy is drastically better at snaking ball screens and creating his own shot that way. I think Jabari Smith needs to watch as much Paul George tape as possible.
Okay.
I see that as being more what the ceiling is if the ball handling, like tightness and comfort, figures itself out. And he's shown enough in transition and off of grab and goes to where I think that there's a world where it gets there. I wouldn't project it getting there as a likely outcome, but I would say that there's a chance that it does get there after 5 years or so that he's in the NBA and he's 23 years old. And, you know, we look up and it's like, oh shit, Jabari Smith is like actually a top 15 player in the NBA now and can create his own shot and is good defensively. I will say, I think he's a bit less. It's so hard because Paul George's developmental track record is so different compared to this, right?
Right.
Paul George went to Fresno State, was considered like a high upside swing that went late in the lottery because he was 6'9" and could really shoot. And it took him a couple years in the NBA even to figure out how to play at that level. Jabari Smith is going to play pretty much immediately in the NBA and it's going to be a different developmental track. But I think that their landing spots could end up the same if Jabari Smith ends up really improving. And it would take some drastic improvement from him as ball handler. Like right now, I think that the Michael Porter comparison is pretty apt in terms of off-ball scorer, great shooter, good cutter, can finish above the rim. Maybe not like as fluid through his hips and like dynamic as Michael Porter can be at times. whenever he's like trying to avoid contact at the basket. I think Jabari needs to improve just getting to the rim more often and consistently finishing at the basket. But I look at Jabari Smith's, you know, long-term ceiling is somewhere on the Michael Porter Jr. To Paul George continuum. And, you know, let's say that it ends up right where Michael Porter is now. That's an efficient 20 point per game scorer. Let's say it ends up where Paul George is. That's, you know, a top 10 player in the NBA. So I think that that's the continuum that he plays on.
I looked it up. Jabari Smith's May of 2003. Also, that makes me feel super old. So that means if he goes pro, next year will be his age 19 season. Well, it's his age 19 season either way, whether it's in college or the pros. So very young, but having that skill set to get there. And then defensively, it sounds like you are seeing him, you know, 6'10", 7'1" wingspan as more of a 4 than a 5. Is that maybe a little bit John Collinsy, where it's like he can do it in a pinch, but it's not his best position defensively?
You know, I see him more as a 4. I think he has better lateral quickness than John Collins had, especially entering the NBA. John has gotten a lot better in terms of his angles and positioning, and his just like, I think John Collins is like a maniacal tape watcher, from what I gather, in terms of just like wanting to know exactly what he has to do at all times. Like, the guy just loves basketball and has figured out a way to compensate for his lateral agility, which is like, okay, it's not terrible. It's not like some significant liability, but it's not great by NBA 4 level. But because he's so smart and has understood his angles so well and has gotten really in tune with his footwork, John Collins has become a good defender in a way that I think a lot of people pre-draft did not necessarily project for him. In the case of Jabari, I think Jabari actually has the athletic tools to be a real switchable defender at the four position. Again, I would not say that he's going to be like a Paul George level defender. I do think he's ahead of where Michael Porter is, though, if we're going to continue along that, like, you know, continuum, right? Mm-hmm. I think that he has really good instincts for going up and swatting weak side shots, contesting at the basket. I think that in general, he tends to be pretty in tune in terms of what Auburn is trying to do. It runs like a pretty aggressive, like scrambly system from time to time, especially when Walker Kessler is out of the game. They play a very helter-skelter style of basketball that is very up and down and can result in needing some pretty quick twitch, decision-making on defense. So I would not say that Jabari Smith is like one of the best defenders in this draft class. I would say that his upside defensively is pretty substantially lower than Chet Holmgren's, if everything goes right for Chet Holmgren long term in terms of his frame. I'd say it's lower than Jalen Duren and a few other like perimeter players, right? But I do think that he can be a like above average NBA defender, even while carrying a 20 point per game load in the NBA.
That makes sense to me. And if he can shoot at that level and potentially even have some secondary or even primary creation responsibilities, there can be a very valuable player in there, even if it doesn't have that kind of defensive upside. There's actually a discussion Nate and I got into in terms of top prospects. We got into that a little bit. And
like the thing that I would say about Jabari Smith, like when I'm like trying to project like what he can be long term, I would say right now I feel most comfortable saying Jabari Smith at some point will probably be a top 25 to 30 player in the NBA, something like that, right? A secondary ball handler who scores 20 points per game, very high level shooter, very scalable to a lot of different situations, which is really important, I think.
And that's super valuable, as you know.
Super, super valuable player. I do worry a little bit about the upside if his handle does not get figured out, though. I think that that is like the real number one concern, is him just getting more comfortable taking guys off the bounce. But I would think that the likely, if I'm projecting Jabari Smith, I would say that like the likely good outcome for Jabari Smith is him being like a top 30-ish player in the NBA.
Interesting. And then how have Holmgren and Banchero changed their evaluations so far this year?
You know, I don't know that they have. necessarily. You know, both of these guys have been so well scouted over the course of their high school careers. They're one of the few, they're two of the few people in this class that I think that statement is accurate about. Mm-hmm. They've just been seen at a lot of different levels and through a lot of different basketball. Banchero looks every bit the dynamically offensive play, creative playmaker on offense that we anticipated, right? He is 6 foot ten.
Hollinger brought up Melo as a possible comp.
Yeah. Do I think Melo? I would say not quite as fluid through his hips.
That makes sense.
Melo was when he was younger.
Melo's fluidity, like as a scorer, is such an underrated part of why he was so great at those things.
Yeah. To me, with Banchero, it's more like if you combined like Melo with Julius Randle almost. Okay. Like not quite as much power as what Randall has, but has like some of the Carmelo like mid-range stuff that Randall doesn't have in terms of like, you know, ball handling in a phone booth a little bit, right? To be able to create that shot and make contested mid-range jumpers, but not quite as like fluid as Carmelo Anthony is as a scorer either. I do think Paolo Banchero is going to be a 20 point per game scorer in the NBA. I think that he's going to be the kind of guy that you throw the ball to in the mid post as your secondary playmaker on offense. And if you need a bailout shot, he's going to get it for you like with ease. I think that in terms of what his role is, I think that these guys are different. Like LaMarcus Aldridge was much more of a post up, like back to the basket big man, whereas Paolo is a bit more of a perimeter based guy that can, you know, face up in the mid range and score.
Could you make the argument that Banchero is like what LaMarcus would be if he was raised as a player now, as opposed to when he did it?
I think that it's kind of that. Yeah. Like it's what LaMarcus would be developed as now. LaMarcus is bigger than what Banchero is. Like LaMarcus is longer. I think he's 6'11 with like a 7'4 wingspan. Banchero is like 6'10 with a like 7'1 wingspan. So again, you're looking at a size difference there, but I do think that there are some similarities in terms of high usage offensive creator in the mid range who gets a lot of his shots that way, who can step out and occasionally knock down threes. Who can be a part of a good defense because he's really smart and really good with his angles and really good with his ability to just know how to use his body on the interior and know how to use like a very strong frame on the interior to contest inside. And he's not terrible away from the basket, but he's not, you know, necessarily a guy that you're going to trust away from the basket. So I think that you're looking at a guy that can be like a really good high level secondary scorer, maybe could make an all NBA team, like plausibly could make an all NBA team at some point, but more in the vein of like all-star scorer who treads enough water on defense and, you know, plays smart and can be a part of a good defense, but not necessarily like the difference maker on defense that, you know, someone like Chet Holmgren, for instance, could be if it works out.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense to me. And that also makes Banchero, in some ways it's an easy player to fit, but in some ways it's a hard one because you have to kind of fit him in the pecking order in a certain way. Does that make sense?
A little bit, yeah. Like I would really like to see him end up in like Oklahoma City or in Detroit because I think he's going to be able to score from the jump in the NBA. Like I think there are going to be very few worries about him. Like I think he averages 15 points a game in the NBA his first year because his level of polish as a ball handler at 6'10" is ridiculous. Like he can throw like a face up jab step, you know, takes the ball out real quick, left to right crossover, right to left crossover, step back, pull up mid range, like 19 footer and make it. And just totally get the defender off balance, totally throw him off and create that, you know, 40 to 45% look in his case, whenever he wants to create that look. I think that on a good team that has like a preordained hierarchy of players, that might be a little bit harder to fit in. Whereas I think Jabari Smith would be much easier to fit in because he can just step in and be an elite 3-point shooter from the jump. But if it's like Houston to me would be really interesting with Paolo Banchero because like they already have Alperen Şengün, they already have Christian Wood on this roster still. Paolo is like, I don't know where he fits within that realm. Like if I was Houston, I would just move Christian Wood, right? Like, but at the end of the day,
which they might have done by that point anyway.
It's just hard to project that right now because if I'm an opposing team, I don't know that I value Christian Wood, right? And then, you know, the funny thing is we're looking at a situation where if you look at the standings right now, like Portland and Oklahoma City are tied for the fourth pick. And what Portland does here at the deadline is going to be fascinating because if I'm Portland, like I've said this in a number of places, but like I'm getting rid of all this. Like I'm ending this one. It feels like it's time.
I don't want to go fully down the Portland rabbit hole, but the other kind of component that has to be weighing in this process for them is the financial part of it, that Paul Allen, unfortunately, is no longer there. And this is a very expensive team that doesn't have a clear path to being very good. They have a path to being pretty good. I mean, they've been there in the recent past. And I talk a lot about how willingness to pay is not universal. And it's not, you know, I mean, there are certain owners, incidentally, Paul Allen was one of them, who are more willing than others in similar situations to pony up. And I think that's a great thing for the league. I wish there were more owners like that. I lament for many reasons his passing. But I also understand it from a practical perspective, that if your team is not at that level, paying two players, especially like in some ways CJ is more egregious than Dame because Lillard, other than this season, has been so phenomenal. And it's not like Norm Powell's making a ton of money or something like that, but it gets complicated. They have two high profile players that are pending free agents and everything else. So yeah, they're in a complicated situation. Maybe they end up, you know, circumstances dictate it by either Lillard realizing what I think he should have realized a couple of years ago, which is that this team isn't at that level. If that's what he cares about, more power to him if it's not. But
at this point with Dame, it just feels like a game of chicken, right? Like he doesn't want to opt out or he doesn't want to like ask out because he wants to be the guy that stayed. Right. And I totally get that. Like, I think there's something noble about that in the case of Dame.
Well, it's interesting. Right? Like the analogy, and this is going to be a weird cross sport one that I've wondered about with him, is kind of like Ray Bourque, where where it's like, I did everything I could and we didn't get there. And that sucks. And there's a part of that in some ways. And I can't remember exactly what the terms were. I remember what happened with Ray, but I don't remember where everything went. Is that like there could be a mutually beneficial thing here where Lillard says, okay, I can move, and then gets to a circumstance where his team is more immediately competitive, which that seems totally plausible, and where those additional pieces are significant factors in the next great Blazers team. And so in that circle, like, and that in a lot of ways, like it's the part of this that is actually sort of beautiful about the NBA system is that you end up, because of the double coincidence of wants, you end up with teams that are valuing different things. And so you can end up with mutually beneficial transactions. And that's part of why when I've written, you know, trade analysis pieces for The Athletic, I've always tried to not do it in the phrase of who won and who lost, because the answer can be both. It can be neither. And I could see a Lillard trade, depending on how it happens, doing that.
Well, and it's funny, like the thing I've been thinking about is like the Kevin Garnett situation in Minnesota. Yeah. And it's a little bit different because Minnesota had missed the playoffs for three straight years, despite having Kevin Garnett before this. And up until now, the Blazers have been pretty competitive. Like they made a Western Conference Finals. I believe that
they've won Minnesota in the mid to high 40s more than those Wolves teams did, if memory serves.
Yeah, like it was pretty consistent. Whereas like with the Minnesota team, what year did they make the conference finals? Was it 2003 or 2004? It was one of those years, right? But it was just kind of a slow and steady 3-year. I think it was 2004, and then it was a 3-year drop off until the point where they went like 33-49 or something. And it was like, okay, like it might be time, right? And if I remember correctly, like I don't think that like he really truly asked out, did he?
I think it was more like, I'm not going to stop it anymore.
Yeah, like that's what it felt like to me. Like there's,
or at least that's how it was reported. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there's a way to do this. Like I think that if you're Damian Lillard, like you don't have to, like it doesn't have to be like what Ben Simmons is doing. It doesn't have to be what, you know, X, Y, and Z player is doing. Like it can be a circumstance where it's just like, look, it's probably best for everyone involved at this point for us to move on. Like I understand that I don't have like a crazy amount of value and I love the city of Portland, but this team is bad and we're going to get worse because we have no flexibility going forward. And Covington and Yusuf Nurkic are free agents this year, and we have to make some sort of change, right? Like, we can't just bring them back. Like, it probably makes sense at this point just to move forward and move on. I don't know if he'll do that. We'll find out. But like,
and the other
it doesn't have to be this. I just say that, like, it doesn't have to be this, like, wholly negative experience when a superstar asks out after a decade.
It doesn't. And it will be painful if that's what ends up happening for the fan base. But that pain is coming either way, as long as our analysis of where the Blazers are is correct. You know, like, is it more painful to let your star go and have them succeed or fail in a different place? Or is it more painful to see them kind of toil in obscurity and be a, you know, an all-NBA player, or even when he falls to below that level, and never have really had a chance to fight? Like, each one of them is hard. One of them is kind of more satisfying, you could argue, for the fan base, but it's complicated. And
the more complicated part within it is, like, look, I don't know about you, but, like, I don't think Damian Lillard's kind of guy it's going to go for, hey, Dame, you know, we're 13-22 right now, and then in a month and a half, we're 15 games under 500, you know, we're going to shut you down, right?
Oh, I don't think he's going for that. Insane.
Yeah. I mean,
even though it probably would be a good thing for his body after it seems like he either was hurt or played hurt during the Olympics, like, to have that time totally off. But yeah, and especially were it to be that was kind of how his tenure in Portland ended, I can imagine that falling on some really, really deaf ears. And the other, you got into the other part of it, which is, it benefits the Blazers to know sooner rather than later, because you can let those dominoes fall, you know, let Nurkic, let Covington walk theoretically as free agents and do everything else. But being proactive, I harp on this all the time. You know, it's like, when you know, it's so much better to move early than to move late. There are exceptions. Like, I mean, I think Orlando benefited in the Vooch situation. They held a little longer. They got a stronger offer. But generally speaking, it helps to move earlier. And then the other part for Lillard, and this could help, I think this could help in a lot of different ways, is that even with their tumultuous front office, you know, with Olshay's firing and everything else, I'm sure there is a rough understanding within that front office of what offers are on the table. This is not a circumstance where everybody, Olshay on down, has just put earmuffs on and just gone la 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 anytime a team expressed, like, hey, if Lillard's ever out there, this is what we're thinking.
I hope not, at least. Yeah.
I mean, that would be malpractice. And so hopefully there is an idea of who's interested, what would be viable. And I am not firmly in the camp. Like, you want to do right by Lillard, but you don't want to do so in a way that materially weakens the team's circumstance. Because the thing is, both sides agreed to this. You know, like, Lillard agreed to this contract with the idea that ceded a lot of control to the team. He could have signed a shorter deal. He could have done any number of other things, and he didn't. But I also think that being pure Machiavellian zero sum for a player who has given you so much, that would be a little bit ridiculous. But the good news is that, generally speaking, you don't have to make that kind of a decision, because the Sacramento Kings aren't making you the strongest offer for Damian Lillard in most circumstances.
No, the situation that will be the strongest offer in terms of value is Philadelphia.
I would, like, think so.
If they throw everything on the table, which frankly they should, I think, and then you decide whatever you want to do with Ben Simmons, right? Like, maybe it's you keep him and you play with him. Maybe it's you move him somewhere else. I've thrown out, like, the Boston landing spot previously, right? Like, I think that Ben Simmons solves a lot of problems for Boston.
For me, that's the scenario. I'll only lay the basics of this, but I think Simmons makes a lot of sense in Indiana.
Yeah, so I agree with that too.
Simmons.
Yeah.
So the way you solve this is Simmons goes to Indiana, Sabonis goes to Portland, and other resources go to Philly, including Lillard.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Like, I you know, without, you know, like, diving deep into what that is. Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's great.
Yeah. So I think that's one way to make it work. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. Let's get back to some of the 22 guys. And
yeah,
another name we haven't, go ahead.
Well, let's do this. Like, the only reason we went into that rabbit hole is because, like, you know, I mentioned that Paolo Banchero, I think, fits in some places better than others, pre-draft, right? Sure. Like Portland is one of those teams that I think is going to have to make a decision. New Orleans, I think, is one of those teams that's going to have to make a decision. But like realistically right now, I feel confident, like in terms of like who are going to be the top three teams. Like I think that Detroit, Orlando, and Houston are probably going to end up in some order being the bottom three teams, or at least three of the bottom five teams, let's say.
Sure.
We'll see with Oklahoma City. Like I would imagine that Shea is not going to want to like totally get shut down again. So maybe they could be a fourth. Maybe they end up more in like the 6-7 range. But the rest of these teams, like Portland, New Orleans at some point is probably going to get Zion back. Indiana, up until these last like three games, has been a little bit better, right? Sacramento, you know, has not been great, but I think they still have a desire to make a push for the play-in game, and they're only, I believe, like two games out of a play-in game as of the time that we talk. I really like Minnesota. Minnesota's in the play-in game. San Antonio's in the play-in game. Both of those teams, though, could easily decide to move more toward, you know, the tanking avenue of things. So I just say all this to say, like, this draft is going to be a real eye of the beholder draft at the top. I don't think we're going to know who is going to go number one, at the very least until the lottery, because there are just going to be, there's going to be enough closeness among this top three and potentially the top four to where there isn't going to be like any semblance of, okay, this guy makes more sense here, this guy makes more sense there. And then on top of that, we have a season where realistically we only know who like three of the bottom five teams are going to be. So I think that this is the draft where I have the least certainty about number one overall and who it's going to be and where he's going to end up and everything than I can remember. You know what? Like, I think that this is just a wide open scenario, right?
Yeah, and that totally changes the way teams think about positioning and a lot of other things, but the flat and lottery odds complement it. And so the player I wanted to get to after that, and I think that's a really kind of good way of setting this table, is Jaden Ivey, because he's another player who I was largely unfamiliar with, having a huge year at Purdue. What do you see? Like, it's, I mean, what do you see his role, not right now, but let's say 2-3 years from now on a decent team?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Jaden Ivey plays more of the two guard now at Purdue, much in the same way. Do you remember like how Eric Bledsoe played the two next to John Wall at
Yes.
Kentucky, right? Like it's kind of like one of those, except, you know, Jaden Ivey is more the John Wall in terms of usage. But I just mean in terms of like positionally, he's playing a little bit more off the ball than on the ball. But when he's on the ball, you see these crazy flashes of vision and of like ball control, live dribble passing, especially out when he has a little bit of space out in transition. It's very impressive. The thing that I think, you know, we should mention the shooting. There are evaluators around the league that certainly still have some concerns in terms of his shooting. Look, like I have some concerns, like I won't deny that. But if you go back through his high school track record, he knocked down 40% from three over the course of his final three seasons in high school. Last year at Purdue, he shot 25% from three. Then this year, right now on five attempts per game, he's at 45% from three. And he's made some pull-ups, like he's made some interesting, you know, impressive attempts, right? So that's 4 of 5 years now where he's been above 40% from three. I'm not saying he's like an elite shooter, but I think he can shoot on some level. Like, I think he has some real touch and he just needs to work through some mechanical deficiencies at this point that hinder his consistency.
Okay.
Now, the big thing that I think he needs to work on is something that we've seen early on with Jalen Suggs in Orlando, because Jalen often played off the ball at Gonzaga and because AAU basketball is what it is. I think that Jalen early in his Orlando career struggling with the, and look, we saw 20 games up until he broke his wrist, if I remember correctly, hand, wrist, whatever it was. I think he was struggling to work through his pick and roll reads early on and keep control of the ball and do all of that simultaneously, right? I think it's more of an experience thing with Jalen Suggs that is just going to continue to grow and mature and keep getting better over the course of his career. I think I see some of that with Jaden Ivey, where he's such a reactive player that he just kind of makes things happen right now. He's such a freak athlete in terms of quickness and athleticism that like nobody can stay in front of him when he's out like in the semi break and catches like a double drag in transition and has a roller and has like a corner pocket 3-point shooter that he can throw a cross corner kick out to Sasha Stefanovic or whatever, right? Like, I think he's just so reactive right now that he doesn't really need the like tried and true, oh my God, I need to get through all of these reads right now. I need to like, you know, work my way through my first progression to my second progression to, you know, cross corner kick out to, okay, I need to escape dribble and then we need to reset the offense real quick, right? Mm-hmm. Much in the same way that Jalen Suggs is struggling with that with Orlando early on. I think we might see some of that with Jaden Ivey, but I don't think that diminishes his long-term upside, which I think is that of a top 10 starting point guard in the NBA eventually, if it goes right.
And then defensively, because I mean, I know he's around 6'4". Is he agile enough to defend them, or is he more of a guy who runs the show but defends twos?
He doesn't defend at the point of attack all that often right now.
Because they're not asking him to.
They don't ask him to. He has all of the tools to be able to do it. There's no reason to think that he can't do it. It's just we don't have the experience of him doing it at this point. And we will have to see how that plays out. Some guys are really good with it. I think he generally does an okay job of like navigating screens when he's asked to inside ball screen scenarios and things of that nature. But, you know, I think that it's... I can't sit here and tell you like I know for a fact that he can be a plus defender, but he has all the tools. He's 6'4". He has like a 6'7" wingspan. He's very like his twitch is off the charts. Like he is such a twitchy athlete that there's no reason to think that he can't do it. It's just going to take, look, it just might take some time, right? His upside is very, very high though as a lead ball handler, I think.
The reason why that matters to me in Ivy's case is because I see one position, two defenders, and maybe he can switch a little bit, but I see one position, two defend, like shooting guard defenders as so much less valuable than guys who can like do two and anything else. And that's it. Like, so it's an interesting question to kind of see where that can go for him. And that, you know, it's not going to be why Ivy gets drafted high or low. Like, I think offense is such a dictator of that, but it will be important in terms of his eventual success.
Yeah. Like I'm going to be going into this draft assuming he can defend ones and twos, because there's no, again, like I've seen nothing in his tape that makes me think he can't defend twos or can't defend ones. You know what I mean? It's just that he's not asked to do it. Like all of the twitch, all of the athleticism, like that stuff's there. Like there's no, just because, you know, Anthony Edwards wasn't asked to defend ones at Georgia doesn't mean that I think he can't be switchable onto ones. He's been okay. Like his problems are more off the ball, right? Like Anthony falls asleep sometimes, but when he's on the ball, like he's really engaged and can handle 1-3. And he's stronger than Ivy. And I think that Ivy's more of a 1-2 as opposed to a 1-3 guy like Edwards is. But yeah, like all of the twitch, all the athleticism, like he works hard. I see no reason to think that he can't be a, maybe not necessarily like an elite defender, but a positive, you know, helpful defender on some level.
Yeah, makes sense to me. I mentioned this in the open, but something I found really fascinating, I think it was mid-December, you wrote a piece for The Athletic talking about how while there are other players that some have with first round grades, one of the less common elements of the 22 draft as of then, and you can correct me if it has changed since, is that there aren't as many consensus first round quality players. And
yeah,
that is, first of all, it's obviously bad news for teams in the late first round, but I mean, some of those players will establish themselves and differences of opinion are not the same as those players are not good enough. But do you think that's just like, you know, we talk about stars, starters and rotation players as kind of like that. Those are my differentiators when somebody says, is it a good draft class? And does it feel to you like maybe that starter group is a little weaker this year?
I would say that this draft particularly has fewer sure things. This draft is going to be a lot of upside swings.
Well, I mean, in some level. Isn't Jaden Hardy another example of that? Like he's potentially like a decent high lottery pick who doesn't seem like a sure thing.
Yeah. Like I'll be honest, like I have Jaden Hardy like in the 20s right now for me personally. I understand having him like in the top 15, but he's just like not my kind of player type. Like it's the same with Cam Thomas last year. Like I had Cam Thomas at like 23 or 24. I'll be honest, I think Jaden Hardy is a worse prospect than Cam Thomas. So, like, what are we – it's trying to navigate that, right? You know, there are guys –
Well, and it's also like, guys like like Peyton Watson not having great – not at least not having the opportunities yet so far, but not really – I don't think there have been many of those guys that have really established themselves other than you wrote about Agbaji at Kansas, who is really doing that.
Yeah, no, I think Oshai has been phenomenal this year. Like, he's taken all of the feedback that he needed to and turned it into a real player. When do you think turned himself into a real player? When do you think the last time that Peyton Watson made a field goal in a college game was?
I would guess like a month and a half ago.
Yeah, it was November 22nd against Bellarmine.
Incredible.
So before Thanksgiving, he made it, or like right around Thanksgiving was the last time he made a field goal. And look, like UCLA has been hit by COVID. They've, you know, missed some games here and there. Maybe he'll come back from this little break that they're on. And, you know, he's figured some things out that Mick Cronin wants him to figure out. Right. But I don't think there's any circumstance where we can project him entering the 2022 NBA draft right now. Just because, I mean, like, when was the last time a guy went a month and a half without making a field goal? And
this isn't a James Wiseman situation.
Yeah, like he's just not playing. And it's not necessarily his fault that he's not playing. He's just behind Jaime Jaquez and Johnny Juzang and Jules Bernard and David Singleton, all of whom are juniors and seniors and you know, guys that Mick Cronin knows and can trust. And that's not to say that Peyton Watson's upside is any less than what we thought it was 4 months ago. I was always a little bit lower on Peyton Watson personally than what I think the consensus was. Like, I never had him at, you know, I think there are other people who had him like at four or five at one point. Like, I always thought of him as a, you know, if things go right, he'll be a lottery pick for UCLA this year.
Sure.
But, you know, like, it's the guy's gone a month and a half without making a field goal. Like, we can't, it's hard to project that guy, you know, entering the NBA draft right now. Max Christie was a guy that I loved coming into the year at Michigan State. He was phenomenal in the preseason for them. All of the reports out of East Lansing were great, and he looked, by all accounts, like a real player. You know, he had 17 points against Oakland on December 21st, and he had a good game against Louisville. He had a good game against Toledo. He had a good game against Butler. Like, he's had some pretty nice outings, but then you look overall at the numbers and he has a 48 true shooting percentage right now. Nice. I mean, like, it's tough to project that as a first round pick. You know, JD Davison statistically at Alabama is someone that's having a pretty solid year. Like, you look across the board and, you know, his numbers are pretty good. Like, he has a 60 true shooting percentage. He has a 29 assist rate right now. But you look at his games since December 11th, 8 points, 4 points, 4 points, 5 points, had 8 turnovers in their last game against Tennessee, has a 31.7% turnover rate. He plays off the ball essentially as like a, like, passing two guard almost. He rebounds well as a 6'3" guard, but how much of that is actually going to be his role at the NBA level? I mean, the numbers look fine, but you actually watch the tape and it's like, this guy has shown nothing that makes you believe he can be an NBA starting point guard beyond just being like a freak show athlete. Like, he has, doesn't really make pull-up jumpers, makes passing reads more like off the ball, like, and in transition than he does like makes high level pick and roll like decisions, right? So, you know, are you going to take that guy at 12? Like, I wouldn't personally. I would consider him like as a late first round pick, but, you know, that's a guy in the freshman class that's succeeding right now in many ways. So, and by the way, like, that's a guy where his athleticism is so drastic and twitchy, and like, he is an elite athlete by like NBA point guard standards. So if he develops all of the tools that he needs in terms of ball handling, pull-up shooting, everything, it's a long road and it's going to take multiple years of development, but there's real, like, okay, he could be a top half of the league starting point guard if he gets all of those tools, but like, the hit rate on that is low, right? Yeah. Like, it's just not going to be someone like, that's not a likely outcome, but it is a potential outcome. So there are a lot of guys like that, I think, in this class where the potential outcomes are high, but the potential bust factor is also pretty high if we're being real with it. Like I think the bust factor in this draft for a lot of players is very high. And I think that there is a lot of, there are a lot of like landmines, or there are a lot of like just absolute fundamental enormous hits that teams could get, like all the way down at like 25. Like you could find a starter at 25 in this class just as easily as you could find a starter probably at 15 right now. Oof. In this class.
That's wild. And I mean, we're deep
like that, that middle ground, like the difference this year is like that middle ground. I think that there's a much lower bust factor in that middle ground for someone like Oshai Ogbaji, like worst case scenario, 40% 3-point shooter, good defender. Worst case scenario, Oshai Ogbaji is probably an eighth man. Whereas with someone like JD Davison, like worst case scenario is this guy like might be out of the NBA at some mm-hmm. point within the first like 4 years of his career. But in terms of that like starter factor, yeah, I think that like you're just as likely to find one at 15 as you are at 25 right now.
Incredible. One other guy I wanted to ask you about, just because I was going through one of your pieces and I was stunned that he exists. There's another Nance.
Yeah, like, this is the good Nance, actually, the one that was like expected to be a very good prospect, whereas like Larry ended up at Wyoming and had Crohn's disease. I think he still has. I don't know if you'd lose Crohn's disease.
I believe he still has it.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, apologies, I'm not like super familiar with the disease, but you know, someone who had real questions and just worked his ass off and worked his way into being a first round pick. Pete Nance was always like a top, you know, 75 to 100 recruit in his recruiting class, and you know, someone that evaluators really liked coming in and thought he was a potential NBA player. And he's finally kind of emerged as a potential, you know, real option for a team in the second round. The difference between Pete and Larry is that Larry is a bit more
Larry Jr., right?
Yeah, Larry Jr., the Larry Nance that plays for the Portland Trailblazers, right? Larry Jr. is just a bit more twitchy than Pete is. You know, Pete is athletic and can be a rim runner and can be actually a pick and pop guy. Like, he's shooting 42% from three so far this year on like three attempts per game. And he's been a great free throw shooter for the last couple of years. So there's some real like touch there. Similar level passing ability, similar level dexterity, like in dribble handoffs and all of that stuff, but just not quite as twitchy. Like with Larry, his whole value proposition is he can be an elite level defender 3 through 5, and switch out onto ones and twos and, you know, be able to slide. And then he's an elite help defender because of that twitchiness. Pete isn't a bad athlete by any stretch of the imagination, but he's more like it's almost like better version of like Dean Wade for me. Okay. Right now. And like Dean Wade has turned himself into like a real NBA player. So, you know, I don't mean that as a like wildly negative statement either. It's just that I think that it's a little bit of a different player in the case of Pete versus Larry.
That all makes sense. I think the way that I want to end this is not teams to watch, you and I've done that a lot if you have one that you think of, but it's what players in this class have you enjoyed watching the most? Who is this year's Bones Island?
Oh, wow.
Because now people have a chance to watch these guys. So if you say, you know, I don't know who it is, but they'll have a chance.
Yeah.
Even before the tournament.
So I love watching Baylor. Baylor is probably my favorite team in the country to watch. I think that they just like play such a fun brand of basketball. They're the number one team in the country. They have a top 5 offense and a top 5 defense. Like, none of this is breaking news necessarily, right? But I really enjoy watching Baylor. I really particularly enjoy watching Kendall Brown out of Baylor. Another guy that's 18, doesn't turn 19 until May. He only had 4 points in a game against Iowa State earlier today and was okay. But a guy that I have as a potential top 10 pick in this class, and that kind of says a lot about this class, by the way, that Kendall Brown, who I think I would project as like Aaron Gordon-ish level player, right? I have him at 5 right now in this class. You know, 72 true shooting percentage, elite level athlete, elite level cutter, great player off the ball, 45% from three, making half of a three a game. You know, can make some free throws, has good touch, but it's still going to take some time for him to work through his shooting mechanics to make him a comfortable shooter. has been much more consistent though in terms of production, just due to his understanding of how to play off the ball. So his aggressiveness defensively, he's already a very high level defender on, I would even say, like 2 through 4 pretty comfortably. He's 6'8", maybe 6'11", 7 foot wingspan, something like that. Really, really effective off ball player, and is someone who really enjoys kind of watching for that stuff. It's been really fun for me to watch Kendall Brown and just watch Baylor in general. I really love watching that Baylor team. What I'm trying to think, other prospects, Tari Eason kind of fits that mold at LSU. I just highlighted him on my podcast as a prospect of the week for me. You know, averaging, I think, like 15 points and 8 rebounds, but another super high level defender, great rebounder, great weak side rim protector, can really slide and defend, and then also has great recovery speed defensively. I have no idea if he can shoot. He shoots this like weird catapulty looking shot. He's made 80% of his free throws this year, but only 27% from three. His mechanics are messy, but not broken, is how I would describe them. It's going to take some time for him, I think, to really kind of figure it out. But I do like him a bit. I'm trying to think of other players that have really stood out to me. Blake Wesley at Notre Dame is another guy. I was not super familiar with him coming into his freshman season at Notre Dame, but he has been absolutely outstanding. He is one of the few freshmen in this class that has just consistently been a double-digit scorer per game. He has some shooting things to work through. It's kind of a funky-looking shot that ends up on a straight line, but I don't think he's the best half court creator in this class as a lead guard, but he is a case as one of the best half court lead guard creators at 6'5", very skinny, but I've enjoyed watching him as someone that I was not familiar with out of this freshman class. He came right from South Bend, Indiana, and stayed home, went to Notre Dame, and basically, you know, entered their starting lineup in December and hasn't looked back. Like, he's essentially running their offense right now. He made the game winner for them against Kentucky. I look at him as a real potential first round pick that if we look up and he goes 20th on draft night, I would not be surprised by that by any stretch.
Awesome. I love having a couple of guys to watch. My hope is to watch some of the G League Unite as well between now and the next time we talk, because there are a couple of guys there that are worth. And I think it's Schmitz has been talking up Beauchamp as well, who I saw actually in person.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Like, I like Marjan. I think that there is some real potential there as a wing stopper. I don't quite know what you do with him offensively at the moment. Not really a shooter, really just like a high level cutter at the moment. And I think that that's kind of hard to project to the next level. So yeah, really great defender, great energy, great effort, has a great attitude. It seems like he's really like taken the, you know, junkyard dog idea of what that team needs and run with it. So I really like him. The guy that I like on the Ignite is Dyson Daniels. I think Dyson Daniels is really high level. Great defender, great passer for a 6'6" player, rebounds the ball, just really needs to shoot it to be like a secondary, you know, playmaker. But I'll be honest, like I don't see this year's Ignite team as having, you know, a guy, right? Like last year they had Jalen Green and Jonathan Kuminga, both of whom went in the top 7. Next year, they will obviously have Scoot Henderson, who's on this year's team, but he'll go somewhere in the top 3, in my opinion. This year's crop, it just doesn't really have that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much for taking time. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Yeah, of course, Danny, anytime.
Thanks again to Sam Vecini for taking the time to come on. Always love discussing anything and everything with him. You can, of course, check out his great work at The Athletic. You can and should listen to the Game Theory podcast that he does, which is absolutely excellent. And can follow him on Twitter at Sam_Vecini. Also, Sam has a YouTube page now, which you should definitely check out. And I absolutely, of course, as people probably know, love talking with him and piecing this all together. And I'd like to start watching some draft film a little bit sooner, but it's really going to depend on the ebb and flow of the NBA season and everything else. So it's a constant refrain from me that I wish I had more time in season to look at the college guys, but I generally don't. As usual, if you want to support the show, there are a lot of ways that you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode that is particularly useful for Real GM Radio, because it will never come out on a specific day or week. It's my availability, guest availability, all that fun stuff. You can also leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing. Helps other people find the show. Word of mouth does too. And there's a little bit of, I guess you call it inside baseball, but part of the reason there was a little bit of a delay in this episode is that Real GM Radio has changed homes. While our relationship with Podcast One was wonderful, and I really am appreciative of their staff and everything that happened there, and you'll actually continue to hear my voice on their airwaves just in a different capacity, Real GM Radio is now back with one of our previous homes, CLNS Radio, and I've loved working with them for years. And so when the opportunity came up to figure out what I wanted to do with this, I had a conversation with them and it went very well. And so for you, the podcast listener, my expectation and hope is that it will not be dramatically different, that you still have it pop into your podcast player and everything else. But I'm thrilled to be back with CLNS to revitalize that relationship. And they were always so good to Real GM Radio. So I'm thrilled about that on a personal level. You can also check out my other work. Nate and I are still going strong with Dunked On, public episodes, technically twice a week, but the 1560s typically are the big one there. And then Dunked On Prime covers all of the rest of our week, which is a whole lot of content. We've done some really fun stuff recently, including our biggest storylines of 2021, and then what we think they're going to be in 2022, gamers and all that. And could also check out my written work at The Athletic. I actually just submitted a piece. I do not know when it's going to publish, on Gary Payton II. And we do Twitter Spaces. I'm doing two a week in different capacities. So one will be, we call it Dunked On Live, which is Nate and I taking your questions. And then the other one is shifted around. I actually did a really fun Twitter Spaces with the NBA last week, where I talked with Onyeka Okongwu originally, and then did a conversation on kind of the rookie class and history of rookies and everything else, which was really fun. And then this week, it'll be more of a me answering your questions. It looks like that's going to be Friday. I'm feeling a little under the weather, so I'm kind of pushing it back as I can, but I'm going to do it when I need to, of course. And if you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I'll respond if I can, but reading it is really what this is about. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.